Hi, I'm John, compulsive overeater. I thank you guys for coming out. We'll talk mostly about relapse today. Other stuff will come up, I'm sure. One of the things we're doing is sending around Ask It baskets. There's one on each table, and if you think of things I say that you either want, you know, more clarification on, or a specific thing you wanted a question answered on, feel free to write it down. And if you guys could keep it, you know, it doesn't have to constantly circulate, but if it gets to an end after a certain amount of time, send it back, because, you know, it may go by somebody and they go, I haven't got anything to ask, but then I'll say something they'll think of and then, oh, and they want to ask it. So if we could just keep that going around, you know, we'll take it from there. There's pens in there and there's paper. So let me just tell you a little about myself. I have been coming to OA for 34 years. I have 21 years of abstinence, a little over 21. I've been maintaining about 105, 110 pound weight loss for most of that time. Obviously, thank you. Obviously, you'll notice there's a difference between when I came in, 34, and how long I've been abstinent, 21. Which should tell you that I had a little relapse problem in the middle of that. And having had that, I, you know, it's been a particular a subject I feel very strongly about, and it's one that unfortunately happens in OA a lot more. So I hopefully will be able to add something today that'll help. I'm going to send around some pictures to show you I earned my seat. The one thing I'll mention is I think I'm the only one I know who sends around pictures of somebody other than themselves in addition to his own pictures. And the reason I do that is there's pictures of two sponsees, Jim B. and Dan C., who were sponsees of mine who are dead. Okay, they're dead as a direct result of this disease. Dan had been in and went out on a major relapse. They found him dead in a chair with his various things around him that he had been eating, and Jim was 600 pounds and died in a fire because he was too big to get out. And so I like to mention that because the seriousness of this disease is sometimes lost, and you know, I'm in the program that has a body count, so I like to remember that. So I'll send those and keep sending them around, get an idea. I just want you to know, I mean, I've been pretty much every iteration of this disease. I'm a compulsive overeater. I was bulimic. I was exercise bulimic. And for a really short time, I was anorexic. I'll talk about that a little later. You know, I know we only all have our own recovery to talk about, but one of the things that happens if you've been around for a long time is you see things and you see trends and you see things that you think work better than others. And I'll talk about a little of that today. The one thing I can tell you is that after all these years in program, you know, I moved out to L.A. about 21 years, no, I'm trying to remember, about 21 years ago, a little less, and I can tell you from having lived there, OA does work. It does work if you work it, because I go to meetings with people. I remember when I first started going to the kitchen sink meeting, which is my Saturday home meeting. At the end of the meeting, they do a countdown, and they say how many people have got over 5 years, and you know, God knows how many hands, over 10, almost as many, 20 still loads, 30, and even a 40 or two once in a while. And so the thing is, it does work if you work it, and you just have to know that these are people that are, you know, living happy lives. It isn't just like they've stopped eating, they're leading happy lives, it's free of the obsession, they're at a healthy body weight, and that's what I think why I came in. I don't know about you guys, you know, because I think recovery is not about getting thin as much as it is about getting well, you know, and there's more to getting well than just getting thin. Now, I didn't see that when I came in, that, you know, I didn't come in saying, oh, I want to be well and happy and have a contact with a higher power. I'm like, give me my weight, you know, or, you know, help me lose the weight. But you know, that comes as you know, you go along, you know, and you get well, you have a spiritual recovery, and spiritual recovery doesn't, you know, it means, you know, as much, you know, recovery for the spirit, to have a happy life and to be better connected and all that, peace with ourselves, you know, so you know, but you know, if you do look at parts of, you know, because I go all over the country in this times and even Canada. And there are places where there isn't a lot of recovery. And the problem is that if you go to meetings where there isn't a lot of recovery, part of you thinks, well, that's the norm. That slipping has to be part of the recovery, and it doesn't have to be part of the recovery. But, you know, it's important to realize that. I mean, when I look, and I, like I said, I've spent, I don't know how many years, I've just, you know, part of what I do for a living now is I do, like, sometimes I do a lot of analysis stuff. And looking back, one of the things I really see about this program is that these guys had it. They had it figured out at an early, you know, from a long time ago. I love whenever the first phone rings, everybody goes, oh, shoot! I didn't turn mine off either. So, and I'm very guilty of that as well. But that these guys had it right all along. And everybody's got a different belief in a higher power. And I'll talk about the different levels. But I believe, you, if you read the stories of how these this program, well, this program, at which then came from AA, I joke, I said, God played chess. God played chess. Let's take this guy who had gone over to see Carl Jung, have him come back, meet these people, and, you know, they're in the New York area, and they meet this guy from Brooklyn who's having trouble, and then he goes up to Albany, New York, and, you know, or the guy from Albany, New York comes down, and this, it's just amazing, all the pieces. Actually, the guy came from Switzerland, then to New York, then up to Albany, you know, Evie came down, who was best friends with one of the best friends of Bill. Bill met them, you know, begins to get program, goes out to Akron, and these two come together. And when you read the story, I remember saying to somebody, the synergy of those two people, if you read about Bill, if Bill had done this program all by himself, it would have flared up, it would have been this great thing, and it would have died because he didn't have all of the knowledge of what not to do. You know, he wanted to do commercial stuff and get companies involved. And then you have Bob, and if Bob had got this thing going really well, it would have been a great little program in Akron, and it would have not, probably never left Akron. But when these two guys got together and made it work, you know, again, I just really believe that's part of it. For me, the other thing I did is I looked back, you know, in the last 21 years at my slip and tried to really understand what was going on. Because I got to tell you, the thing about my slip was, first of all, I tend to call it a slip cycle, because it wasn't just bam, I went out and ate and then came back. It was a slip cycle, a week on, a week off, a month on, a month off, you know, 3 months on, 3 months off. And it took me the longest time to realize, and the two main things in looking back is I really didn't understand powerlessness. I didn't understand it as it had to do with this disease. And that was important. And I also really didn't grasp the disease and how it works on me. And I really wish I had, you know, it would have saved me a lot of time and pain. But, you know, like I joke with people when I do this, I said, I'm just the guy who ran through the landmine field first. And now I'm, you know, I'm all cooked and going, watch out for that one, you know. So I'm just going to do a really short thing of my why I ended up here. I am the child of two different alcoholics, two different Irish alcoholics. What are the odds, right? They divorced at an early age, but I kept going back and forth between the frying pan and the fire. My mother was a really low-bottom alcoholic. My father was what they call a functional alcoholic. He didn't lose his job, but he was also never around, and he was he was really an angry guy, you know. And I got a lot of the bad modeling from him on that early on. And the thing about being the child of addicts is you get some really bad modeling, you know? Crazy stuff going on in the house, really crazy stuff, and the next day, everything's fine. Everything's fine. We don't, you know. We also, we talked a lot. We talked about sports. We talked about politics. But did we talk about how we felt in here? Ooh, you know, stay away, you know? And I think the worst thing you get as a kid who's the child of alcoholics or addicts is you know, they won't sit you down and go, oh, here, drink and do drugs, it's really good for you. But what they do is they do things which a smart little kid will watch and go, aha. And what I got from them was whenever they were upset, they'd say, I need a fill in the blank, I need a drink, I need a pill, I need a cigarette, I need something. And what a little kid does is he goes, oh, okay, so if I don't like how I'm feeling in here, there's something out there that I can put in here that will make it better. And I got that at an early age, and for me that was food. And you know, I had a crazy upbringing. My mother was did a lot of what they call an AA geographic cures. We moved all around, and you know, I couldn't hold on any friends, and but the only thing that was constant was the food. You know, I can go to the top of Mount Everest. I'm sure there's a 7-Eleven up there somewhere. You can get your junk food, and for me it was sweet and salt and sweet and salt, and so I had that, and then unfortunately, you know, what the byproduct of that is fat. You know, and I was a little fat kid, and it was miserable. The guy who was the first man in OA was a guy named A.G., and he used to say he was a fat kid himself. He says, there's no hell on earth like being a fat kid, you know, because I've been a fat kid, I've been a fat adult, and, you know, if you're a fat adult, people will make little snide comments once in a while or, you know, talk about you behind your back, but, you know, kids are just, bam, between the eyes and brutal, you know, and so, you know, that was part of it. And the other thing was I was what they call a gifted child, so I was very smart. And the thing about that was when you feel like a piece of garbage about yourself and how you look, you want to grasp on any little thread of self-esteem you can grab. So all my early life, in fact, till maybe 5 years after I came into my first program, I would have to make sure you knew as soon as you met me just how smart I was. And that would mean using big words, correcting your English. Nothing makes you likable like correcting people. And, you know, the problem is that just estranged me even more, you know. But that was my story. I have one unique story that I've never heard in L.A. I'm the only person I know who sent candy grams to himself. Okay, and I'll explain that. Before the days of you know, the internet and credit cards and stuff like that, you know, I'm a little fat kid. I steal money from my parents, because the great thing about having alcoholic parents is they pass out, they don't know how much money they have. But the other thing is sometimes you don't have any money and you want something. And I happened to be watching TV one day. I was lived in New York, and a commercial came out and said, "Candy, you know, candy grams, you can charge them to your home phone number." And I was like, "Whoa, this is great!" You know, so I pick up the phone, I call the number, and you know, you can't just say send the candy; you got to have a gram to go with it. So I'd be like, "Best wishes on your new project," you know, and sure enough, a day or two later, a guy knocks on the door and hands me a box of candy. I'm like, "This is cool," you know. And you know, so my father and a friend, Nick, gets his phone bill at me. What the heck is this? Gee, Dad, I have no idea. It's a mistake. And he call up and yell at the phone company. And then the next month, there's three of them. And, starts going, huh, candy grams, fat kid, candy grams, fat kid. And, you know, like I said, it's a funny story. But, you know, the reality is it's really no different than the kid who just broke into your car and stole your radio because he needs for crack. You know, I was an addict. I'd do whatever I had to do. And I did, you know. And you know, what happened is as I got to high school. Oh, and then we were just talking before the meet, before we started. I ended up in a town called Greenwich, Connecticut. And I, for those of you who don't know, it's sort of the Beverly Hills of the East Coast. Now, we had no money. Okay, so we're living in a one room apartment. This is my father and myself. We're living in a one room apartment. And I'm going to school with kids who are driving Mercedes to school, talking about going to Switzerland for Christmas, and I can't even afford a bike. You know. So, like, I don't feel bad enough about my weight, you know. I had that. And the other thing is that, you know, I didn't want to be fat, so I tried every diet there was in the early days. Dr. Stillman and Metrical, and I'm showing my age here. You can tell your age by who gets up and what diets they talk about. You know? You know, I didn't want to be, you know, I was the only 13-year-old boy in Weight Watchers. I remember that, you know. And I used to say when I first came into the program, I said I tried every diet and none of them worked. But the reality is I tried every diet and they all worked. Because I'm a little brainy kid and I go to school. You give me my class, you know, syllabus, and I will follow it and I'll do great and it'll work the first time. The trouble is I have an addict's brain, which on the second time around is looking for the loopholes, and then of course it falls apart. And that was definitely, you know, what happened to me. I got to high school, I was in with the geeks who nobody else liked, and didn't go to the prom, didn't have any girlfriends. And the other thing was a very party school, and I did not drink because one of the things about being a little brainiac is you read the stories of, oh, children of alcoholics tend to become alcoholics themselves, so I don't want to be like my parents. But, you know, I'm a teenage boy who's terribly shy, is fat, has no self-esteem. I want to meet women because its hormones are raging. And what happened is I found this magic elixir that when I drank some, all of a sudden I felt calm. I felt self-confident. I could talk to the opposite sex. There's a TV show that has the character who can't talk to women unless he drinks. Well, that was literally me. I mean, that was the way I was, you know. And the trouble with that was it didn't take long for that to change my life. First of all, I got into alcohol very quickly. But the other thing about it, and the only reason I talk about it here, is it was the first time in my life I was able to lose weight, you know, because I all of a sudden changed my sugar to the liquid form, and I did crazy weight loss, which was to, like, not eat for a week at a time. And, you know, if you're a 20-something-year-old boy, I don't know how old I was, and you don't eat for a week at a time, and then you binge for one night, and then you don't eat for a week at a time, and you binge, you will lose weight, you know? And looking back, I go, well, you see, I knew even then that there was no dimmer switch on this. You know, there was an off-on switch, and that's all I had. And I somehow just knew that. And so I got down to a normal weight for like about 10 seconds. I had my first girlfriend, first relationship, but then, you know, alcohol took over, and I went from from that in full blast into drinking, and then the drinking led right back into the binging. I always joke, I said I was fat, then I was a drunk, and then I was a fat drunk, you know? I went 0 to 60 on that, and luckily my drinking career only lasted about 7 years, and I came back, I came to AA. I wanted nothing to do with AA. And my first, I had heard about AA, I had gone AA as a kid. I would go with my mother to AA meetings, you know, while she was trying for years, trying to get sober. And AA was the place to get the donuts and the cookies because they would be in the back. And my mother would say, you know, okay, I'm going to, you know, and the thing is, AA has like, at least then it had, you know, a speaker and then a break and then sharing. Well, you know, they'd have a speaker, and while the speaker is on, I'm in the back raiding the food, you know. So by the time, you know, it's a break, what happened to all the cookies, you know? But I remember I came in, and I knew I needed to do something, but I didn't want this because I don't want to be part of this religious program, you know. And so when I finally hit something of a bottom, I ended up in a detox, and I went to, they had been bringing us to this clubhouse, and I ended up leaving the detox, and I actually got kicked out of the detox. That's really depressing. And I went to a meeting, and I ended up talking to the guy who was my first sponsor, and I'm putting away chairs, and I said, I can't be part of this. Well, there's two things. I remember saying to him once, well, I don't think I'm an alcoholic because I stopped drinking about, you know, 3 months ago for a week or two, and last year I stopped for about 3 months. And he goes, John, you know, a person who isn't an alcoholic doesn't have to periodically stop drinking to prove to himself that he's not an alcoholic. Good point. I'm sitting there saying, I said, I can't be part of this religious program. And he said, look, it's not a religious program, it's a spiritual program. And I go, no, it isn't. And I point to the steps and the traditions are up on the wall. See, it says God, God, Him with a capital H, you know. And the guy said the most brilliant thing he could have ever said to me. He said, okay, leave it out. And, this ultra brain is like, what? You know, he says, look, right now your disease is looking for any reason to head out, right? What could be better than to think we're going to make you believe something? I guarantee you, you stay here, you stay sober, you can live to 110 in this program. Nobody will ever make you believe anything you don't want to. You can die an atheist. And the fact that he said it in that way was the key for me. You know, it allowed that door to crack a little, the, you know, mustard seed, whatever you want to say about it. Because if he'd have said, I've heard old timers say to newcomers, oh, just keep coming, you'll get the spiritual stuff. That would have sent me out just as fast, because I was paranoid at that point about, oh, the cult is going to indoctrinate me, you know? But because he said, you never have to believe anything, it allowed me to just start to keep an open mind, you know? He said, look, the only thing I don't understand about God, you ain't it, you know? And that was such an important thing for me to get, you know. And so the thing is, by then I start the crazy dieting again sober, and of course, and then it fell apart, and I actually ended up drinking again for a short time. And then when I came back, I knew I needed OA, because, you know, you come into one program, you start hearing about all the others, and you know, and when I heard of OA, the light bulb, well, of course, now I get it. This, you know, this you know, great brain of mine is of no use because it's the same as AA. And so I went to go back. I came back in and I said to the guy who became my sponsor the second time around, I said, I need to go to OA. And, you know, like in AA, they're like, oh, no, here, have a donut, you know. And I'm going, no, you just, I need this. And I need these two things go together. And he said, okay, fine. You know, I don't care what you do. As long as you make the meetings I told you to, I don't give a, you know, whatever, what you do. Because they're real touchy-feely over there. And I did, and I fell in love with OA. It all of a sudden, everything made sense, and I got a sponsor, and I instantly abstinent, you know, pink cloud, the abstinence fairy hit me on the head with the wand. It was easy, it was simple. I'd look around and go, why are these people having such problems, you know? And my sponsor left program, and I'm like, I don't need a sponsor, I got one over there. And I did well for a while, and then it fell apart, you know? It absolutely fell apart. And what happened is I'd worked in a magazine, and then I was trying to get into stand-up comedy, so I was busy at night, and also there's no time for meetings. But you know, by then I had understood, no, I am a compulsive eater, and I had my food plan. I came in right after Gray Sheet, but they had the old Dignity of Choice, and I had my food plan, and I realized, okay, I'm a compulsive eater, I just have to stick to this food plan. And the great thing about this disease, it's really patient, you know. I stopped going to meetings, and it was probably the better side of a year. And I still remember a bunch of us were, I was playing at Dangerfields in New York, and somebody said, hey, we're going to go down to Chinatown after the show. You want to go? Oh, sure, you know. And I went down, and I started eating, and then bam, I was off to the races. Every night I'd leave the clubs in New York, and I joked my car, I nicknamed my car Meals on Wheels, you know, because it was, you know, all the way home, you know, I used to joke when I was drinking, you could hear the clink of bottles under the seat, and after that, it was like the wrinkle of cellophane, you know. And I was off to the races, and it took a while, you know, at that time, I was slipping and sliding. And you know, I look back now, there's two things about that early time. I lost the weight so quickly, okay? I was, you know, when you're 20-year-old male, you know, you got the metabolism of a hummingbird, you know, you lose the weight really quick. And that's the other thing, is that I had such a grandiose idea. If you've been fat most of your life, you have this grandized idea of what goal weight's going to be. You know, it's almost like you can hear angels singing, goal weight! You know? And I got down to that weight, and nothing changed. I didn't like myself any better. I didn't feel more confident. I had this crazy idea. I'd get to that goal weight and I'd like myself and I could talk. I'd be swole, hello, darling. You know, I don't know. Some of my head, I'd end up with a British accent. I don't know what that means. Women would be clawing at my ankles as I walk by, you know, or whatever. And nothing happened. I got to the same weight. And so then the genius that I am says, well, must not be the right number. So I lose another 10 pounds and nothing happened. And then I lose another 10 pounds and nothing happened. And that's the one time I was anorexic in my life. I had people coming up going, dude, eat something, you know, and are you sick? And what it taught me is there's no number on that scale that's ever going to be anything for me. Now, I think I had to do that. I don't recommend it, but I had to do that to see that. The other thing in looking back about that first grace abstinence, and I think a lot of people get that first one. They get the one easy one. And I think I have a quintessential, I've seen this story over and over and over in OA. The people who come in, it's easy, it's simple, you know, and then they go out and then trying to come back, you know. Over in AA and NA and places like that, they'll talk about the addict trying to chase that first high, meaning, you know, it's never as good as the first time. And I think I kept chasing that first abstinence. I wanted it to be easy. It was supposed to be simple, you know, and it wasn't, you know. And in looking back, the one thing I finally dawned on me is, you know what that first abstinence was? It was just another diet on that list of diets. I came in, you told me what to do, I took my brain out, I did what you said, and then the second time, I'm making excuses, I'm making judgments, and if, you know, it didn't work. So it took me a while. By the way, are you guys cold here? You want me to close this?
No.
How many? Okay, okay.
Are you?
No, I'm fine. But you know, if anybody is, I mean, if there's any group conscience on it, don't. This is just the way it came. I started to do better. I got in with a really good group in Darien, Connecticut, and I did really well. I lost the weight I had been on, and I got married, and was doing stand-up comedy full time after that. My wife and I moved out here to LA and everything fell apart. I could not stay abstinent. I would get, like I said, a week on, a week off, you know. And the thing about that is, it wasn't, this is not a person who had just left program. I'm going to meetings. I'm going to 3-5 meetings a week. I've been around all this time going to 3 or 5 meetings a week. I can quote you huge chunks of the first 164 pages of the big book, and I can't stop eating. You know, I remember I was secretary of a meeting called Artists in Abstinence. I was a sponsor, both of which I probably shouldn't have been because I was into food. I had a sponsor. I was delegate in my intergroup. And I remember I left that meeting as secretary, and I stopped at the donut shop on the way home and bought a bunch of stuff. And I'm leaving the donut shop going, why am I doing this? I'm not sentenced to OA. If I don't want to go, I don't have to go. But that was that pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. And for me, that was looking back, not understanding the disease, you know? And that was an important thing. And I did the slipping, sliding, and it was absolutely miserable. And finally, what happened that changed things was I ended up going into a different program that had a much more structured food plan and everything, and I was bound and determined. And the other thing I knew is I went into therapy. I'm a big believer, and in the big book it talks about we're not professionals, of getting outside help. Bill Wilson had it. Because I knew something was bad. I could not figure out what it was. I could tell the fact that I wanted it so badly, but I couldn't get it. Something, there was a fight going on inside. And when I finally got abstinent, you know, it was like right here in front of my nose, and I couldn't see it. Yeah, I love that great line. You want to find out what you're eating over? Stop eating. You know, and it's absolutely true. And what it turned out is I was in a marriage I didn't want to be in. And I'm a people pleaser. I am a caretaker, alcoholic child of alcoholic personality. And to have to go to tell somebody who loves me that I don't want to be in this, it was just too horrible. So what happened is I kept wheeling that huge thing between me and the thing I couldn't deal with, which was the food. Now I'd be on that cycle. You know, the circle cycle was I'd be abstinent, and then I'd think about going out, and I'd be thinking about it for a while, then I'd end up going out and eating, and I'd eat and eat, and then I'd gain a bunch of weight, and then I'd get back to program, and then I'd be obsessed with losing the weight I gained, and as soon as I got back here and everything got quiet, the whole cycle started all over again, because I just couldn't deal with what was really a problem. And thanks to the grace of God or whatever, finally, you know, I hung in and worked on it, and I got abstinent, and I ended up getting out of that marriage. It was very tough. It turned out to be the best thing for both of us. She found a wonderful guy, and I found somebody wonderful, and it needed to be done, but, you know, it wouldn't have happened. I think I'd still be miserable in eating if I hadn't, you know, gotten to that point. And so it's been 21 years since then, and it's been an interesting ride. There's been ups and downs, death of my mother, and you know, I actually was abstinent through that divorce. And it's such an important thing that, you know, there's a great quote. I love to quote this. It's in the fourth edition. It's on page 450. And in case anybody's interested, it says, and I'll just keep it in the AA version. I realized I had to separate my sobriety from everything else that was going on in my life. No matter what happened or didn't happen, I couldn't drink. In fact, none of those things that I was going through had anything to do with my sobriety. The tides of life flow endlessly for better or worse, for good or bad. I cannot allow my sobriety to become dependence on these ups and downs of living. Sobriety must have a life of its own, which is true, meaning stuff's going to happen all through life. You know, I have sponsee who, you know, went out on a binge. He says, well, I went on a binge because this happened and that happened and this happened. I go, no, you went on a binge because you're a compulsive eater. You know, I don't care what it was, whatever you went through, did you think about going to place a bet on a horse? No. Well, I'll go to a GA meeting and hear your story that ends with, and that's why I bet. And because he's a compulsive gambler, you're a compulsive eater, we have an abnormal reaction. A good friend of mine who leads retreats says, food isn't the problem, food is our solution. You know, and we need to realize that that's the problem. And one of the things I love to talk about sometimes, and it never gets, I don't think it gets enough play in, you know, because we're up here, whether it's this kind of thing or just a speaker, and we want to be positive, is to say something that can be heard as negative, but it really isn't. I wish somebody said it to me when I was either new to program or coming out of my relapse, and that this is hard. You know, every once in a while, somebody should say, this is hard. It's not hard all the time, but it sure was hard when I was first trying to get back from the relapse. And I just wish somebody would have said that, because I'd have felt more validated about that, you know. Because in it, when I was first getting abstinent in that other program, which is the beginning of my abstinence now, I went through a number of different sponsees who were wonderful ladies who, when I was just, you know, climbing the walls and couldn't stay abstinent, they'd be like, well, think good thoughts, pray to your higher power, and finally I ended up with this guy who says, okay, here's the key. You're in your first 30 days of abstinence. It's going to suck. Now, you know what? It didn't suck every day, you know, but occasionally it did. And when it did, I was able to go, oh, okay, I'm right on schedule. And when it didn't, I felt like I was ahead of the game. But I was given a more of a reality base that I wish, you know, I needed, you know. And I tell people, you know, I actually wrote an article for a website where I, you know, being in both programs, I said I think food is way harder than alcohol, you know. And you know, I said it was really hard for me to get sober, but I think it was 1,000 times harder to get abstinent. But it's like 100,000 times harder to stay abstinent than to stay sober, you know. You know, I have quit drinking. I haven't been around it for years. My mother had finally stopped drinking, had the worst, you know, stopped going to program, had the worst attitude I would never want. But she never drank again because she didn't have to be around it. She hit enough of a bottom. And but I think we are not, you know, we don't have that luxury, you know, because we have, you know, it's always said, you know, we have to take the tiger out of the cage 3 times a day. And I know people say, well, alcoholics have to drink, they just can't drink alcohol. I can only tell you, this alcoholic has never had a drink of any kind of a non-alcoholic thing that made me want to go have something else. But I've been in a not fit spiritual condition and finished my abstinent meal and went and stood in front of the refrigerator open, you know. I don't care how many years you're in program, this is going to be a day where you're just standing there looking for the secret of life in there, you know. I always say, I'm going to put a tanning bulb in there. At least I'll get something out of it, you know. But that's just it. The other things about it, this is with us from birth. You know, I don't care, you know, how bad an alcoholic addict, you're probably not getting into your teens, but this stuff's with us from the beginning. It's mother, love, reward, all these parts that we have trouble, you know, splitting in our heads, you know. It's socially acceptable, right? You turn on TV, there's food porn everywhere, right? Food porn in the you know, not only in the TV, but on ads, and you know, and everybody seems to, you know, it's almost encouraged. You know, you never see at the end of any of these food commercials, please eat responsibly, right? Right? But you know, and people don't understand. I'll go to a party and somebody will offer me a drink. I go, oh no, I'm in AA. Oh, I'm so sorry. You know, it's like, yeah, 34 years. That was the one that was going to make me go out. But then a little while later, they'll come up and go, oh, you got to try this cake. I go, gee, you know, I'm in OA too. I don't eat that. Oh, come on, you can have one. You know, they just don't get it. I've had people, I remember I was in my AA meeting, my men's meeting was a noon meeting. And at the end of the meeting, I said, guys, you got to come to our meeting tonight. I said, I got to go speak at an OA meeting. And he looks at me, you're in OA, you're not fat. And I'm like, yeah, and you're in AA and you're not drunk. You know? You know, the point being, if anybody should get it, it should be them, and they don't, and doctors don't, and everybody doesn't. The only people that ever got it for me were here, my family, and I need to remember that, you know. You know, it's so funny. I tell this story sometimes. I had a business meeting, and actually both the people knew I was in OA, and so we're having this business meeting at the Cheesecake Factory, right? And we get to the end of the meal. I had my salad and everything, and the woman who was like sort of my boss says, so you don't eat any kind of dessert? And I said, no, I'm fine. Well, we're going to order a ice cream thing. Is that going to bother you? No, it's fine. Don't worry about it. So they bring out one of these big things of ice cream and 2 spoons, and they each take a bite. And then we start talking about this project we're working on. And they keep talking, and they keep talking. And I am looking at that ice cream melting and melting and melting. And finally I just said, hey, I just have to tell you something. You'll never understand me, but I'll never understand how the hell you could sit there and let that damn thing melt. You know? But you guys get it, you know, you guys get it, the other people won't. The other thing that makes this hard is there's a billion easier, softer ways that are out there, right? You know, to this day, you know. I mean, I'm a smart guy. If I get one of those emails from the Nigerian prince who's promising me $1 million, I laugh and I delete it. But I'll be standing in line after 34 years in program at the supermarket and look over at the, you know, thing, lose, eat all you want and still lose weight. Huh, I wonder what that's about, you know? You know? It's just not. It's you know, and we want to minimize it. It's just food. Well, you know what? For us, that's it. You know, is the problem. You know, also, you know, as an AA crossover, at least I'm not drinking. Well, you know, I'll be the most sober 600-pound guy in the AA room, you know, and I can't do that, you know. And it's so funny, you know, over in AA, you call that sobriety, we call this abstinence. You know, what is, you ever look up a definition of abstinence? It's about refraining from altogether. So they should be abstinent. We're the ones who have to have the sober relationship with food, right? You know, that, it's amazing when nobody ever catches that. There's another thing about this disease that is almost unique to this disease is sometimes the result of good working a good program brings extra problems. You know, you don't hear anybody in AA, oh, you know, I got sober, and oh, then I got all these problems due to sobriety. No, but, you know, if you're a young woman who's really overweight and you lose weight and all of a sudden you become attractive, there's a whole other set of problems, you know, and that's almost unheard of in these other programs. You know, and obviously the thing that's in AA, you know, people drink alcohol because they like the effect. Well, we like the effect that it did. It did something for us. It calmed us. It soothed us. We like the taste, you know, whatever. And, you know, it seems benign, you know. But, you know, it isn't. You know, we it says in the big book, you know, if we drink again, we'll die. We just don't have that same feeling for most of us. We're not... But we will, in a lot of ways, die. We may not die. I love my other friend, my friend in program, who says, "I'm not as much afraid of dying of this disease as I am of living the death of the Walking Dead." Meaning, I get up, I go to work, I come home, I eat and binge, I go to sleep, I get up, I go out and work, and that's what I was doing. It became such a small life when there's, you know, this huge world out there, and. And that's the problem. And the worst part of this disease, and I'll stop talking about how hard it is, is that it's the way in which it delivers the pain. You know, if there is something good to be said about alcoholism and drug addiction, which, by the way, is a line you won't hear very often, something good about drug addiction, it's that it slams you face down into the pavement, and then there's an occasional time where you may come up with a point of lucidity of, what the hell am I doing with my life? But food has that dull, chronic pain. It's a dull pain that makes you, you know, it's hard, but it's not that hard. And what it is it allows you to keep moving the goalposts, especially if you're smart. Well, I'll never get to 200. Well, I'll never get to 205. And I'll start looking in the mirror from here up, and I'll start wearing elastic waistband things. And it just constantly allows you to accept that which was previously unacceptable to you. You know, you find a way. And, what makes this disease so hard is that it helps you know you need to do something about this. It just doesn't make you in enough pain to be willing to go to any lengths, like it says in the big book. And the reality is, if we're trying to work a program that's based on AA, and it's based on the things written here, that's what we have to do. And it may mean that you have to make a little bit more of an intellectual leap, you know, and to me, that's, you know, a big part of it, you know, because I use the analogy as a sort of a famous thing out there about scientists. If they take a frog and they bring it toward a pot of boiling water, the frog knows it's something it doesn't want to be near and it wants to get away. But if that scientist takes and puts him in a pan of room temperature water and then just slowly brings the heat up, that frog will never jump out. It'll die in there. And to me, that's the perfect, you know, analogy of our disease. We'll just constantly, the heat will get worse, but we'll somehow deal with it. And you know, again, you know, it's what happened. I remember the guy I talked about, Jim, who died in the fire. I said to him, the guy was brilliant, by the way. He was brilliant and he was me. I mean, we had that same sort of sarcastic thing and funny and sharp. And he was 600 pounds, you know. And I used to say to him, I said, Jim, the only difference between me and you is I had the gift of alcoholism. And I saw what I had to do for the first program to get it. Otherwise, if I hadn't drank, I probably would have been him, you know. And the thing I said to him once is, if I could go back in a time machine to, you know, let's say you were in college and you were 200, 250. And I told you, someday you're going to be 600. You tell me, nah, no, no way. Well, you know, nobody goes from 250 to 600. You go from 250 to 260, 260 to 70. And that's, you know, that's what we're, I knew I was on the, you know, the thing for, you know. And, you know, I'll tell one last story. A good relative of mine had a wife My wife, okay. Whose mother died of cirrhosis of the liver. And here's the key. She didn't drink. She was a sugar addict. And sugar, if you eat enough of it, you get a fatty liver. And if you get a fatty liver, it can turn into cirrhosis. And, you know, so that's another example of our disease, you know. You know, and so, I, you know, I'm not going to keep going on about that. But, it, you know, for me, I think that the answers are all in here. For some people, it's real hard to read the big book sometimes because it uses archaic language. And it uses, you know, sometimes sexist, you know, everything's about men and stuff like that. But the, you know, the answers are in here, just maybe sometimes they need to be said a different way. But I mean, I believe absolutely this is a mental, physical, you know, spiritual disease. But I also believe in terms of spiritual thing, I believe in sort of the grounded out version, you know, a 12-step thing, which is God, myself, and another human being, you know. Because I always joke, I said, you know, me and God can go into a closet somewhere and I'll pray and come out convinced, like chocolate's a vegetable, you know. Yeah. But then I pick up the phone and I call my sponsor and he's like, yeah, for today, I don't think so, you know. And that's the problem is that, you know, if I pray and I try and meditate, I don't know what's the voice of my higher power and what's the voice of my disease just doing a really good impression of my higher power, you know. And that's why I have to ground out with a sponsor, a God squad, all that kind of stuff, you know. And so for me, I, you know, not understanding the disease was a big part of it. You know, I would say, you know, again, I'm a good little student. You tell me it's a disease, I'll tell you. It's a disease, it's a disease. I think it took me years to look back and say, you know, I think there was a part of me that just said, okay, if it makes you guys feel good to call it a disease, call it a disease. Today, I really get this is a disease. You know, none of us wanted this, for one thing. It has the exact same symptoms. I'll go to my Serenity Sunday meeting and hear some lady in from Bel Air get up and tell her story, and next week there'll be some guy from South Central and they're telling the same damn story. It may have the you know, the specifics are different, but the same underlying, you know, pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization is, it's there, it's the same thing, you know. You know, they're finding out more and more every day of the things that we talk about and program based on science. And I happen to like that. I happen to have the kind of brain that likes hearing about the fact that this stuff is being reinforced as real disease. You know, in the big book, there's a place where it talks about we passed an invisible line where we could no longer take it or leave it. Well, scientists found it. There's an enzyme that burns out in the human body called alcohol dehydrogenase. And when it does, you can no longer drink safely. I happen to be one of those people. If I have my first drink, you know, you can put, you know, all the linebackers from the Los Angeles Rams between me and that second drink, and damn it, I'm going to get there. But with this disease, I couldn't make the same equation. You know, it wasn't exactly the same here. And that's what I couldn't get, you know. You know, and but for me today, the more I can grasp it as a disease, it takes it out of the realm of guilt and things like that, you know. Because look, you know, we all have probably had friends who've gotten cancer, and we don't say, you're such an idiot for getting cancer, right? And if they go into remission and then it comes back, we don't say, I can't believe you got cancer again. Didn't you learn the first time? We understand that is something they don't want. But you know what? Cancer is being grown in their body. They are making the cancer in a way. And so it is a physical version of our mental cognitive thing. We don't want this, but it's in there. And the more I can start to grasp that this is something I don't want, I can fight it. When it's just me deciding to change my mind for the 5,000th time, it's just the toughest thing in the world, you know? You know, the idea of it, I couldn't get it, you know. You know, like when I moved to L.A., I started getting the L.A. Times every day, you know, and because I wanted to become an L.A. person. And after about 2 or 3 months, I started realizing they're piling up and, you know, now I'm just killing trees. And so I called up and canceled it. But you know what I didn't do? The next day I didn't go, send me the L.A. Times again. You know, and then the next day I said, oh, no, cancel it. And then, you know, but that's what that's one of the differences between an addiction and other choices. You know, I wasn't just choosing again to eat after I told myself I wasn't. You know, God, every Monday, right? Every Monday, every first of the month, every first of the year. First of the year, gosh, that's the one. You know, I remember, I'm doing it first of the year. Well, my absent date is March 7th. Gives you an idea how long it took that train to come to a stop, right? You know, but that's just it. We have, like it says in the program, you know, we have an allergy of the body, an obsession of the mind, you know? And the thing is that what I finally got to see was how, I believe, how my disease works on me. I always like to say my disease is like the world's best salesman, okay? Now, if anybody knows a guy who's a salesman, they're smooth and they're likable, right? And they like their product, they're confident in their product, and they know you like the product, in this case, food, right? And they keep my disease is trying to continually, you know, sell me on the idea of going out and eating stuff I know is not right. And that salesman is around 24/7, right? And the other thing about that salesman is he can read your mind. So anything you're going to get ready to say, no, I can't have that, it has the answer. Well, no, you know, you can start again tomorrow, or any of those things. The really evil thing to me about my disease is that if it does make the sale, if I do go out and eat, it then puts its arm around me and says, and by the way, this was your idea. You know, it wasn't my idea. When I was driving home after having bought those donuts that day after leaving the meeting, I didn't make that decision. My disease made that decision. If I really wanted to eat, I wouldn't be going to all those meetings. I wouldn't be a sponsor. I wouldn't have a sponsor. I wouldn't be a delegate. I would just be out there. But at that exact moment of impulse, it convinces me I want to do that. Everybody is here today. So I'm sure you got better things to do on a Saturday than this. You don't want to eat. But then when that impulse hits, it's your idea. Or that's what it wants you to tell you. And that's where I had to start to see things differently. That those voices that are telling me to do that, they are my disease attacking me. And if I can see that as something outside coming at me, I got a chance to defend against it. But if it's just me changing my mind, I'm screwed. I have no way to stop that, you know? And, you know, that's just, you know, that obsession of the mind, allergy of the body, obsession of the mind. There's somebody said once, I couldn't stop once I started, and I couldn't stop from starting again. You know, I always liked that, you know? You know, and when I really believe the steps are the answer on this stuff. You know, I believe there's a perfect flow to these steps. One flows into the next, which flows into the next. And I always talk about, I think there was two forms of steps in my recovery. The first was like steps 1 through 3 and the tools which helped me get abstinent and hold on to that and get the food down. And then the other steps, which helped reinforce. When I see people who've gone out after 5 or 7 years, chances are they haven't really worked the rest of the steps very well, you know. And, you know, complacency is a killer. You know, I have it now, but I can lose it any time. And the other thing is my disease, I think after a certain amount of time, I always joke, I say, you know, if you want to think of the old, like a metaphor for these days of like the zombies, and we're in a house and we're, you know, we've bolted the front and back door against our disease, which is like the first three steps and tools and things like that. But we got all these windows, and the steps are helping us nail something over the windows, because that's how our disease will get in. My disease will get in through my character defects, because it knows, you know, honesty and immaturity and things like that is how it'll get in. And so when I finally got to that point of being miserable, you know, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length, step zero is like they say, you know, it's the way it is. You know, you have to be sitting in meetings and knowing something's not right sometimes, you know. On my slip, you know, when I was in the middle of that slip, again, all these years in program, one of the things is, you know, like in the big book, it only talks about a certain amount of places it talks about slipping and relapsing, and it tends to be almost like a one time, and you know, Joe went out and had this happen, and then he came back and saw how he needed to do things differently. But again, with us, with that slipping and sliding cycle, you know, things are different, you know. And my disease used all of the things that I learned in program, perfectly good program concepts, against me, you know. I believe my disease can, you know, can mutate and use every little bit against me, you know. And it doesn't matter, you know, my brain and my intelligence, and, you know, I've been on Jeopardy, woohoo, you know, didn't stop me from, you know, pounding my face with food at about the same time I was doing that. And, you know, I love it. There's a lady named Marcy in our area says, you can't fix a broken brain with a broken brain, you know. We need help from outside. And you know, I look at my disease, it was constantly the, you know, tomorrow, you know, that was the other thing. You know, I go to meetings with, you know, those people at kitchen sink, you know, 20, 30, 40 years in program, none of them ever started on a tomorrow, you know, they all started on a today. And I guarantee you, every one of them, you know, when they started, got to about day or three, four, and had, oh, what the heck, let me go do it, and something made them say, just for today, get through today, and that started, you know, and same with me, you know, why? After all those times, I always say my higher power just decided, okay, he's done, you know, he's been beat up enough. And I think it's so important, you know. My disease used all the, let me just give you some of the things I used to say. Well, I'll work on the steps and then I'll get abstinent. Well, you know, I've read that book, I don't know how many times, where it says, and when you're done with all these steps, you will then want to stop drinking. You know, I know there is an occasional story you will hear in program of that happening, but I think for every one of those people, there's 1,000 trying to chase that lottery ticket. You know, the lottery ticket of work, having it work the other way around, you know. I'd have a food plan that Henry VIII could, you know, could stick to, you know. So, well, you know, I'm on my food plan, I'm abstinent, you know. You know, I'd be 3 meals and a snack. Well, what was a snack? Pretty much anything I ate after dinner, all the way through. And I'd probably eat more than I, you know, did, you know. You know, and I would say things. I remember saying, "Well, you know, I can't be on a diet." You know, oh yeah, I can't be on. Well, you know what? We're all on a diet of one kind or another, right? I've been on a no liver diet since I left my mother's house. You know, you know? And we're all on some kind of a diet. Or when I was slipping and sliding, I'd come to the meeting. Well, I ate again yesterday, but I'm not going to beat myself up. And then I'd show up the next day. Well, I ate again, but I won't beat myself up. And finally, I had an old timer say, "Do you ever think that eating last night was beating yourself up?" You know, it was like, ooh. I remember saying once at a meeting, I said, "I guess I haven't hit my bottom yet." And one of the old timers says, "You know, bottom's not the goal here." You know? You know, one of the other ones is, I'm praying for the willingness. I'm praying for the willingness to stop, you know. And I was at a convention. I heard a lady who was a convention speaker say, when it comes to addiction, willingness is highly overrated. You know what you need? You need pain. Now, pain drives you to the willingness. But the idea of just willingness, you know, I couldn't see it. But all of those crazy things I was saying were my disease talking, and I couldn't see that. Because my disease, when I was in the relapse, got up every day with one job to do. And that one job was to get me to kick the can down the road one more day on actually putting the food down. You know, and if it convinced me of that for that day, it could probably convince me tomorrow. And that was the thing I just couldn't understand, you know. I couldn't understand any of that stuff, you know. And today I finally get it, you know. I knew what I have to, you know, I need to be doing these things, you know. I can't lose track of the simple things, you know. And I look at the people I have respect for in program back down in LA, and they're doing the same things today that they were doing when they first came in, you know. And that's what we have to do. This disease just sits and waits for us to get complacent, you know. There's an old saying from the American Revolution, the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. Well, I think the price of abstinence is eternal vigilance. I mean, I don't have to be crazy. I don't have to be afraid of the food. But I have to realize my disease will figure a way in. I always say my disease will back up to figure a way in. You know, there's famous science fiction stories out there. There's one movie in particular where there's an asteroid heading toward Earth. And if asteroid's heading toward Earth, one of the things scientists have figured out is you can't just go up and blow it up, because then you'll have 15 asteroids heading toward Earth. What you do is you go out far enough. If you go way, way, way out in space, you can just nudge that asteroid just a hair. And it'll miss the planet by, you know, millions of miles. Well, that's what my disease does. It keeps backing up and backing up and backing up to find a way to just nudge, you know. My disease knows today it can't say, hey, let's go to 7-Eleven and eat all the ice cream. But it'll keep backing up until it can find a way. And maybe it's, you know, you're going to too many meetings. You know, you don't have to go to too many meetings. And if it can nudge me that way, who knows where that ends up going off to. And I need to realize it's always there, you know. And I'm a big believer in, like, for one thing, I tell my sponsees, have a plan of action. What happens if you really have that urge to eat, you know? And in the old days, we used to have, you'd have a phone list in your wallet. Now we have phones and we can have 100 names in there. And I tell sponsees, look, get go up and talk to people. Say, I want to put you on my phone list so that you have you've broken the ice. Let them know who you are. And then find out who's up late, who's up early, so that you can call people late at night. Or if it's early in the morning, you can call them so you know and have that. Because, you know, what it comes down to is having a commitment to abstinence, you know. It's one of our great pamphlets we have, the commitment to abstinence. That and before you pick up the first compulsive bite. And I believe I can't commit to being abstinent. I think abstinence is a gift. But I can commit to putting as many impediments between me and that first compulsive bite as I need. And for me, that is a key, that it's not, you know, it's a big part of it. You know, I'll talk in a second about the whole thing. I need to have some kind of surrender, you know. And the commitment to abstinence, the way I explained it to a sponsee once, I said, yes, it is a day at a time. We work this a day at a time. But if you're going, well, I may eat tomorrow, I didn't eat today, and you get up the next day and you say, well, I didn't eat today, maybe I'll eat tomorrow, but we'll worry about that then. I said, it's like going down a street with 100 bakeries. And you walk into each bakery, you open it up, you sniff, you go look in there, and you say, nope, I'm not doing that. And you go to the second one, nope, I'm not doing that. Well, you get to the 99th or 100th, and you go, well, you know, I've been so good. The key is to walk down that street and not see the bakeries. And that's where, you know, I can go today. I've finally gotten it. And part of that for me was surrender, you know. And they talk about the difference between submission and surrender. I was done, you know. My buddy Harlan always says, surrender is just joining the winning side, that's all, you know. And for me, and part of that, and maybe we'll take a break after this, is I didn't understand the powerlessness. You know, I would say, again, I'm a great student, you know. You tell me I'm powerless, fine, you know, and I'd send that right back at you. Yes, I'm powerless. But in the middle of that slip, I'm out there, I'm powerless, and then I go eat. And then I come back, no, I'm powerless, and I go eat again. And I'm powerless, and go eat. Well, what was I really saying to myself? First of all, I never even thought about it because I didn't want to. What I was saying, you know, was I saying, oh, the hell with OA, I'm done? No, I was saying, when I am done, I will come back and I will get abstinent again. You know, and why? Because I had done it over and over and over again. And the reality was I couldn't get that because, you know, I knew, having had that experience, if I went out and ate, if I came back, I might have to go to 90 meetings in 90 days, I might have to get a new sponsor, I might have to do all kinds of writing, but eventually I would grind that train to a halt again, you know, for the 50th time. And I could. I was powerful over the food in the small picture. The trouble was, because I knew that, I was already setting up the next one before that train even came to a halt again, you know, because I didn't believe I was powerless over the food, you know. I believe I'm powerless over a bullet and a gun. You know why? Because I've never put a gun to my head, and as I'm pulling the trigger, say, well, I'll start again on Monday, you know. I get that's not going to happen. But with the food, I had convinced myself. And anybody who has broken their abstinence and gotten it back over and over, there is a part of that. And it took me a long time to look back and go, you know what? I didn't break my abstinence and get it back over and over. I was on an in-and-out cycle. I wasn't really abstinent. I was just on another in of an in-and-out cycle. And things didn't really change until I kept the food down, really got in, worked the steps, and really tried to get this. You know, every time I was on an in cycle, it's like having a car with a broken accelerator in the car. The engine's like revving like heck, and all you've managed to do is put the car in neutral. You know, so it's sitting there going whiz. Now it's not hurting anybody, it's not going anywhere, but it doesn't take much to accidentally nudge it, and boom, it's off again. I needed to get the steps and the program to help me get the car off, dismantle the engine and do that, because it was the only way I could guarantee it wasn't going to start again. And again, that was part of that powerlessness I couldn't understand, you know. And part of it, you know, when I came into the program years ago, we used to always say, we don't eat no matter what. Like, we don't eat no matter what. Real hardcore, you know. In fact, you were actually obligated to pound on the podium. But I heard somebody say it a much nicer way. They said her sponsor told her, if you're a compulsive eater and you've made food an option, it's always going to be the only option. It's always going to be the path of least resistance. You know, if you're going through some kind of emotional pain or something's going on in your life and you have a chance to eat something that at least, you know, makes you feel good, you like the taste of, or, you know, at least used to make you feel good, it's a no-brainer. You know, it will happen. But, and that's where my, I had to change how I saw my powerlessness. Because my powerlessness with food was never going to be the same as my alcohol powerlessness. It had to be simple. Simply, food is not an option, you know. We got a guy down there named Terrell who always says, if it's not an option, it's not a problem. And it had to be that. I can enjoy my food. I have perfectly good meals. Sometimes they're a little larger than I want. But it, the food is no longer an option for when things are bad. And they also have to stay, for me, within my own food plan. You know, and so that was, for me, starting to come to the idea of the first step. I'm powerless over food, and my life is unmanageable. And it's like, you know, once you know that, it's like, oh my God, where do you go from there? You know, you're screwed if you don't find a power greater than yourself. So I'll tell you what, we'll take a break, and then I'll look at some Ask It Basket questions, and we'll take back up. So that's it for the moment. Yeah.